Get back to after doing all the quantum field theory in closed spaces and so on, which is really sort of the formalism built up this, we'll get back to what inflation actually is. And just to recap, inflation was invented really to solve a set of problems, was really to explain why the universe is as homogeneous and isotropic as we actually see it right now. That's one of the basic assumptions in cosmology. But the universe actually, as we see it right now, according to the hot Big Bang theory, is too homogeneous and isotropic because you have a set of problems associated with that. Probably the most important is the horizon problem, which is basically the fact if you only had the hot Big Bang period, hot Big Bang, which means just the sort of right radiation and matter epochs prior to our current epoch, then the universe would always have been decelerating in its expansion. And that basically follows directly from the Friedman equation. You have h squared is 1 over 3m Planck squared rho, minus k over a squared if I had in the curvature piece, where and the rho satisfies rho dot is minus 3h p plus rho. This is just conservation of energy. And this comes from G00, component of Einstein's equations. And those two equations put together apply the following statement, that a double dot is equal to minus 1 over 6m Planck squared p, rho plus 3p. And so in general, for radiation and matter, the pressure is positive, the energy density is positive, so the a double dot is always less than 0, so gravity implies that the universe will decelerate in its expansion. But if that's true, we have the following issue. We know that physical length scales expand with the scale factor in the universe. They get stretched by the expansion. But we also know that in a cosmological FRW spacetime, there is a characteristic curvature scale, which is the Hubble radius. H minus 1. Now, if we look at the ratio of the physical length scale to the Hubble radius, we get something that scales like A times H. And the Hubble constant, of course, is defined as A dot over A. So if we look at how this quantity changes with time, so this is lambda co-moving A dot, if we look at how it changes with time, the rate of change of this quantity, lambda phis over h minus 1 is lambda co-moving a double dot. Here the dots are made with respect to cosmic time. I'm following my previous conventions where eta is conformal time, t is cosmic time. Then this quantity is less than 0 in a decelerating universe. So then the statement is that what happens is that physical wavelengths, although they're getting bigger because of the expansion of the universe, the Hubble radius is also getting bigger, such that the ratio of those two is actually decreasing. So in a decelerating universe, physical wavelengths are always coming inside the horizon. So they start out with a wavelength bigger than horizon size. And then although they get stretched by the expansion, the horizon actually gets bigger faster. And so if you look in terms of co-moving scales, effectively the wavelength ends up coming inside the horizon later on because of this fact. Now, that's one way of stating the horizon problem. It's not the most rigorous way, because really it's the horizon problem is a statement about causality, is that the modes coming inside the horizon right now, the longest modes we see in the CMB, would have been out of causal contact in the past in a decelerating universe. But this argument roughly captures it, which is that in the past, the modes we see coming in now were long, very long wavelengths. And the scale of causal interactions is always roughly set by the Hubble scale. So what that means is when the physical wavelength is bigger than the Hubble scale, then different points along the wave couldn't be in causal contact with each other. Yeah?
I didn't see what the problem here is. So the big length scales, wavelengths are basically becoming inside the horizon.
Right.
And why is that a problem?
Let's suppose we're here, and we're looking out in the sky, we're surrounded by a horizon. We're looking at the temperature of the cosmic microwave background fluctuations. So we look out in this direction, and we find the temperature, is whatever it is, 2.73 Kelvin. And we look over here, and we also find the temperature is approximately 2.73 Kelvin with small fluctuations. So the problem is that this point and this point, the wavelengths associated with that physics are coming in the horizon right now, but those wavelengths in the past would have been even farther away from each other. So so what it means is that these two points in the past would have been out of causal contact with each other. So the problem is, now, there's no actual inconsistency here. It's more a statement of how on earth could it possibly be that two regions of the sky, which have been out of causal contact until they just come inside the horizon, could possibly have the same temperature.
So I guess I got confused by the use of the word wavelength, and I was associating with that some sort of physical mode.
Yes.
But here you're just length scale is what you mean by that.
Well, the argument is two ways, and I'm arguing in terms of the wavelength here because you can argue it both ways. This is the momentum space argument, but there's an actual proper physical scale argument as well. But this is the one that's actually more useful for doing the argument when you see at the level of the perturbations. So when we talked about the two regimes, Inda Sitter, k eta bigger than 1 and k eta less than 1, these two regimes corresponded to physical wavelength less than the Hubble scale during inflation and physical wavelength greater than the Hubble scale. So in terms of wavelength, when the modes are inside the horizon, that's when they're oscillating, that's when they can be in causal contact and have interactions and so on. When they're well outside of the horizon, that's when they're effectively out of causal contact and frozen. Okay.
That the Hubble radius is getting bigger faster than the...
So it's in this ratio. So the ratio of the physical wavelengths to h minus 1 scales like a dot. If you differentiate that, you get a double dot. So the rate of change of that quantity in time is a double dot. And if the universe is decelerating, then a double dot is less than 0. So that means that this ratio is getting smaller. Make sense? Right, so we know that lambda is getting bigger, but the ratio is getting smaller, so h minus 1 must be getting even bigger. I'm talking about the standard hot Big Bang phase when it's matter and radiation dominated, where it's decelerating. We know it's accelerating now, but that's only at very late times, and that's not enough to resolve this particular problem. Right. The point is that most of the period, the radiation epoch and the matter epoch, the universe was decelerating, and so this ratio was getting smaller. Okay. So the resolution of this is simply to have a period where you have acceleration and you switch around this behavior. So if we plot in co-moving wavelengths, so the physical wavelength gets bigger as the scale factor. The Co-moving wavelength is the guy that's defined to be constant, so it's really the physical distance. Co-moving distance is physical distance divided by the scale factor. So co-moving wavelengths remain constant with time. Let me measure time in log of the scale factor. So this is lambda co-moving. But what happens during the decelerated phase, so during the radiation plus matter epoch, is that the Hubble radius in those length scales gets bigger. So this is h minus 1. So in co-moving, this is the co-moving Hubble radius. So in co-moving coordinates, the wavelengths remain constant. The co-moving Hubble radius gets bigger, and so modes eventually come inside the horizon, which simply means that their wavelength becomes smaller than the Hubble radius. And inflation resolves this, because this occurs because A double dot is less than zero. Inflation resolves this by having a region where A double dot is greater than zero, so that originally, the modes we see coming in now in our universe, in this previous period they were outside the horizon, if you go all the way back during inflation, they would have come back inside the horizon. So in this region, they're oscillating. This region, they're oscillating. And over here, they're not oscillating. They're kind of frozen in. So in this region, they can be in causal contact. Those particular modes can be in causal contact because the wavelengths are smaller than the Hubble radius, which sets essentially the causal length scale over which things can interact. In causal contact here, this is where the perturbations are created. That's where the temperature is set, and then the modes go outside the horizon. They're out of causal contact. They just remain frozen. They come back in again, and they start fluctuating. And that's what we see now. Which, this line?
Yeah.
This is the Hubble radius, co-moving Hubble radius. Okay. So you're saying that the co-moving Hubble radius gets smaller during inflation, but it gets bigger during decelerated phase. So this is the period of inflation. It's simply a period where the universe is accelerating. And that's the definition. And since A double dot is minus 1 over 6m Planck squared, rho plus 3p, then to get that to work, you need the pressure to be greater than minus 1/3 rho. Sorry, less than minus 1/3 rho for this quantity to be negative. We need rho plus 3p to be negative, which is the same as the pressure being less than minus 1/3 rho. Now, and cosmologists usually define the equation of state W as the ratio of the pressure to the energy density. And so what we have is that we have acceleration if and only if W is less than minus 1/3. So if the universe is dominated by some fluid whose equation of state W is less than minus 1/3, in this region the universe will accelerate. That brings the co-moving Hubble radius down. So that modes that are initially inside the horizon, inside the Hubble radius, will go outside the Hubble radius, and then eventually they come back in again in the decelerated phase. And so this is the region when they can be in causal contact. They go out of causal contact, but they come back in again, and then we see. And so now we say it's no longer a surprise. As long as these fluctuations that give rise to the CMB temperature were produced in this epoch, then it's no longer a surprise that they were that they can be correlated over length scales comparable to the horizon. Is everyone okay with that? So one thing you already note is that to get inflation, you have to do something kind of crazy because you need some fluid with negative pressure. And most matter we know doesn't have negative pressure. So now the second problem is the flatness problem. This is why is the universe so flat? This problem arises because if we write out the Friedman equation, the curvature of space comes in like that. It goes like 1 over the scale factor squared. And when we're writing that, what we mean is that the metric on a curved space, on a maximally symmetric three-dimensional space, can always be written in the form dr squared over 1 minus kr squared plus r squared times the metric on a 2-sphere. So if k is 0, we have a flat Euclidean space, R3. If k is plus 1, we have a closed universe, S3. And if k is minus 1, we have an open universe, which is a three-dimensional hyperbolic space. And the problem arises in the hot Big Bang region, which is just by definition the radiation and matter-dominated phases. Because in the radiation phase, that says that the radiation dominates the energy density, and radiation scales like 1 over a to the 4. Matter scales like 1 over a cubed. So both of these fall off faster as the scale factor increases than the curvature term. Therefore, if the universe is composed only of radiation and matter, and there is some non-zero initial curvature, no matter how small it is, eventually the curvature will come to dominate the universe because it falls off less rapidly than these two components. And yet we look in our current universe and we find that the current observational constraints constrain the curvature to be a negligible fraction of the current energy density. And so, in fact, nowadays most cosmologists would basically treat k as basically 0. So the current curvature we see is at least already in the present universe a negligible fraction of the total energy density. So for this to be small now, it would mean that this would have to be incredibly small at the beginning of the radiation epoch because this thing falls off less rapidly. And that's the flatness problem. And that's solved by inflation as well, very simply, because what happens in general is that, so if you take a general fluid, which is conserved in this sense, that's the conservation law, and you consider equation of state W, which is defined as P over rho, and let's assume that the equation of state roughly remains constant, then this equation becomes the statement rho dot is minus 3H rho 1 plus W. And so the general solution of that is that rho scales like 1 over A to the 3 1 plus W. So, for example, if W is 0, that corresponds to matter. Matter has no pressure, i.e. dust-like matter. And so we get rho goes like 1 over a cubed. For radiation, W is a third. Radiation carries pressure. W is a third. And so we get 1 over a to the 4. So if W is less than minus a third, then this exponent, so that means that 1 plus W is less than 2 thirds, or 2 1 plus W, 3-1 plus W, I should say, is less than 2. That means that any accelerating component for which W is less than minus a third will fall off less rapidly than the curvature component. And in particular, in most inflation models, the equation of state, W, has to be very close to minus 1. And we'll see that in a second. So most inflation models, the equation of state W is approximately minus 1 with very small corrections. And so in that case, the energy density rho approximately scales like a constant. Because 1 over A to the 3, 1 plus minus 1, the exponent is 0, and so the energy density remains roughly a constant. So this is actually the typical situation in most inflation models. The energy density of the inflaton is roughly a constant. It falls off very, very slightly, but not very rapidly, whereas the curvature falls off like 1 over a squared. And if the energy density is a constant, it means you're in approximately on a de Sitter-like space. And in de Sitter, the scale factor increases exponentially with time. So the curvature as a ratio, if you look at the ratio of the curvature term in the Friedman equation to that coming from whatever drives inflation, the energy density of whatever drives inflation in units of m Planck squared, this thing scales like e to the minus 2ht. So because this falls off exponentially, it's a very easy to make this curvature a negligible. You just need a few time periods of order h minus 1. In fact, during inflation, we need the amount of time has to be about 60 to solve this problem, in which case this quantity is of order e to the minus 120. And that makes the curvature a negligible fraction of the energy density by the end of inflation itself. And then you start out, when inflation ends, you start out back into the radiation and matter period, during which the curvature now actually, although it falls off, it doesn't fall off as rapidly as the other components, but it's now started so small relative to those radiation matter components that that we don't have a problem in understanding why the curvature today is so small. Yes, that's right. So the requirements, actually, so a combination of both the horizon, solving the horizon problem and solving the flatness requires this number n, which is called the number of e-folds, has to be of order 60. Angular momentum. The what? That's a good one. Yeah. So, but is that such a problem? Because so these, depends how the angular momentum scales in expanding universe. I'm not sure. I've never heard that one before. So this quantity n actually is usually defined the number of e-folds. The sense of that name, n is defined basically as the change in the log of the scale factor. So that says if A at the end of inflation is equal to e to the 60 A at the beginning of inflation, then the number of e-folds you've had is 60. In other words, it's log A end over A beginning.
Is less than zero.
Yes.
But I'm not sure whether, because I thought we were currently in an accelerating period now.
Yes.
It, So how does that work with a double dot being less than zero?
So we're the period in which we're accelerating now has only been very recent. It's only in the last I have to sort of red. You only see it at sort of redshift one, so basically sort of one e-fold or so. So this problem sets up for most of the history of the universe. It has been true that the modes have been well outside the horizon. So what you're questioning, let's draw it on the plot and then it'll make a bit more sense. So if you plot the co-moving scales, so if we plot how the co-moving Hubble length changes with time, so the fact that if we come into dark energy domination, what it means is that this thing will start to decrease. So in an accelerating phase, this decreases. In a decelerating phase, it increases, right? So most of the history of the universe, it's been going like that. Now it's coming back down again. During inflation, it was like that. So now if you're looking at a particular mode of wavelength lambda, then something like this. So this is the typical mode that, say, we see in the CMB of a given wavelength. This mode, at some point during inflation here, was inside the horizon. Then it goes outside the horizon during the radiation and matter phases. And then it comes in somewhere, typically during the matter phase. And so it's true that now the universe starts to accelerate again. But, of course, it's got a long way to go to catch up the amount that by which this has increased during that epoch. Okay.
At the moment, we're accelerating with W about -1.
Yes.
But we're not exponentially accelerating like we were in inflation.
We are, yes.
Okay.
I mean, we will do. We're not very far off from that yet. I mean, if W is very close to -1, then... So actually, what we mean is that... So if we think about the current energy budget, then... The rho now is rho dark energy plus rho matter, which is mostly dark matter, right? And this thing is basically about 75%, and this thing is about 25%. Now, when we say that W is close to -1 now, what we mean is that this component has W approximately -1. But this component still has W of 0 because it behaves like matter. But this still makes up 25%, so the actual total W, the combination of the two, is not quite -1. But we're not far off this thing dominating, and of course this thing, the ratio, this thing will only get smaller relative to that with the expansion. So a couple of e-folds away, which is actually which is quite long time in real time, because we're measuring, our current Hubble scale is time scale is like, 15 billion years or whatever, so an e-fold is now corresponds in time to several, several billion years. But nevertheless, we're not far off from the region in e-fold time where this guy is really coming to dominate. And so, indeed, in this region, the solution is approximately an exponential. The only difference is that in inflation, this H is a very large number. Currently, it's a very small number, so even the accelerated expansion doesn't look very fast. You see what I mean? Because this is so small, we're not quite there yet because this guy is still around at 25% level. So but nevertheless, it is true. If this comes to dominate, then everything we're now saying about inflation will basically apply in the dark energy phase. However, it hasn't happened long enough yet to really affect. So it's true that in the dark energy phase, modes will eventually go back outside the horizon again, and everything will go out of causal contact. That's because the universe is accelerating, everything gets stretched, it goes outside the horizon, and yeah, it's going to be quite a boring end state of the universe. But no.
I don't think so.
Unless you have a liberal definition of life, but essentially everything's getting stretched, right? So you'll see the
you know, the sky will get darker and darker, and you know that everything goes out of causal contact, and so I think, you know, causality, whatever your definition of life is, no matter how liberal, if it's not in causal contact with its neighbor, then it couldn't possibly be life, right? So that's yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so gravity wins for your local gravity wins for a long time. That's true. But you'll have isolated. So it's a matter of length scales. The galaxies will sort of get. You're right. The local. I have to think about that. This is way off topic. Suffice to say, life's pretty boring, but anyway, so it's back to inflation. So, so the point is that although the universe is accelerating now, it doesn't really invalidate the argument I just made because it hasn't had much effect yet. Yeah. Say that again, sorry.
For W plus or minus
one. Oh, you don't know yet. So we're gonna explain that in a second why that's true. I'm just saying that's the tip. That's actually typically what comes out. It was not guaranteed. All we were guaranteed is that had to happen was W less than minus a third. But in fact, it'll turn out that all the ways we know how to make inflation actually end up with this condition more or less true. And we'll explain that in a second. Okay. So the last problem is the monopole or sort of relic problem, and this is perhaps less significant because, this is perhaps less significant because it assumes the existence of monopoles and other topological relics. And it was a historical problem in the days when, well, it's still a problem now, but if you believe in grand unified theories typically have monopoles in them, and they can be created during phase transitions, and yet we don't see those around right now. And similarly, you can have other topological defects created by phase transitions of the early universe. We don't see these things right now. There are strong constraints on their absence. And so why don't they exist? And inflation resolves that also basically because it wipes away all the initial conditions. Because monopoles, if they existed, they'd just behave like matter or dust, which means that they have an equation of state zero, which means that the density of the monopoles scales like 1 over a cubed. And similarly, if we look at that ratio to the ratio of the inflation, then this is something that typically scales, actually in most models when W is approximately minus 1, scales like E to the minus 3 times the number of E folds. And so again, in this case, if you have 60 E folds, this is suppressed by E to the minus 180. However, if you didn't have inflation, because this scales like matter, then during the radiation phase, it's actually the dominant it actually increases relative to radiation, and then during matter phase, it remains a finite proportion. And so that's where the problem arises. But again, inflation just resolves that by wiping away those initial conditions just by stretching everything. So at the background level, that's what inflation does. It's a means of wiping away initial conditions, making the universe look extremely sort of homogeneous and isotropic, explaining why we have the same temperature in completely different regions of the sky with an extremely isotropic distribution. And that's what inflation does at the background level. So how do you achieve that? How do you build a model that does that? Well, it's really a simple question of how do we come up with some model, theoretical model, that gives equation of state W less than minus a third. That's all we've got to do. The problem with that is that requires having a model in which the fluid has negative pressure. And nothing we know of, nothing we've ever measured in the lab, has negative pressure. And so this is kind of a problem that the standard ingredients that you have in the standard model, none of these can possibly achieve this, except perhaps the Higgs. And the Higgs is okay because Higgs is a scalar field. Now, of course, when I said that nothing we've actually seen in the lab has negative pressure, of course, we haven't actually seen the Higgs. So that wasn't inconsistent. But the punchline is that the only things that we know of, more or less, that can have negative pressure are scalar fields. Now, in nature, no one has yet observed a fundamental scalar field, but we're still hoping, basically. And scalar field models are the natural physical means of giving rise to inflation. And they do this because with a scalar field, I have quite a lot of freedom in what the physics of the scalar field is. Because in general, I'll have some kinetic term for my scalar field if I write down the action. But I also have a potential. And it's this freedom to choose a potential that allows you the freedom to make the pressure negative. Now, most other types of matter, we don't have such a freedom in the choice of the interaction. So, for example, for electromagnetism, for a massless photon, we know the interactions have to be gauge invariant, and that restricts us in the number of things we can possibly write down. We can't write down an arbitrary function of A mu because this is not gauge invariant. That wouldn't be allowed. And similarly for higher spin fields. But scalar fields are the one exception, really, the way we have a tremendous amount of freedom, because the action has to only be a scalar function. That's all that's required by general coordinate invariance. And so I can make an arbitrary function of a scalar field in the action. Yeah.
Do you consider renormalizability?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So if I took a massive spin 1 particle, then I can have such a thing, but those interactions are typically not renormalizable.
But in scalar fields, any arbitrary potential won't be renormalizable, right? Or it'll be
there. Oh, that's certainly true. That's certainly true. But most inflation models, the potential is not renormalizable.
It's not.
That's right. And we don't feel bad about that. And the reason is that we're dealing with gravity here. Gravity is not renormalizable, and the inflation theory is treated as an effective field theory, in which there is going to be a cutoff where things break down, which is definitely the Planck scale. But yeah, in general, this is not these potentials are not renormalized in 99% of inflation models.
That could be a motivation for string theory because string theory.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. And it's, you know, in fact, so that's one of the big things in current research is coming up with, models. It's very easy to write down a model that gives you inflation, and we'll do that in a second. It's very hard to embed that model in the context of a high-energy physics model like string theory, precisely because what we'll see is that the potentials required are both either non-renormalizable or require the field to be bigger than the Planck scale. And that's something that's difficult. That's something that's kind of pushes it naively, doesn't go outside the regime of additive effective field theory, but it does get in an awkward regime in terms of trying to embed this in a quantum theory of gravity. If the scalar field starts getting the bigger than the Planck scale, then you get very worried. Okay. So let's see how this works actually in practice. So what I'm going to do is imagine a scalar field in general, which goes by the name of the inflaton, as just the name given to the field that drives inflation. Now, it could actually be more than one field, but the simplest models have a single field. The original, one of the original hopes is that the Higgs could be this guy, the inflaton that drives inflation, but it turns out when you take the Higgs potential here and you plug in the numbers, you get the wrong scales, that it's actually inconsistent with what we know, with the data we know from the cosmic microwave background. And so that rules out. But nevertheless, that was a pretty good idea in terms of inflationary models. Nowadays, we look for these scalars could be Higgs-like fields, not the real Higgs, but some other Higgs. You know, it could be a real or complex part of a complex field. There could be many different fields here. There could be some moduli associated with extra dimensions, the size of some extra dimension. Could be the position of some brain in extra dimensions. These are all the kinds of things. Could be an axion. These are all the kind of things that people think about. And actually, the truth is we don't really have much clue what the fundamental particle is that field is describing. But what we do know very well is that this kind of thing can very easily give you rise to inflation models. And so actually our problem at the moment is a lot like dark matter. We have lots of potential candidates for what the inflaton could be because it's a pretty generic mechanism. It works well. It works too well, in a sense, the mechanism that which makes it difficult for us to figure out what the particle is. So for now, anyway, we're just going to think of this as some scalar field. And I'm going to think about what does the action look like. I'm going to derive the equations of motion in the following means. I'm going to think about what does the action look like. And just for simplicity, I'm going to assume the universe is spatially flat, which is a sufficiently good approximation that people do this most of the time anyway, so that this will make life easier. And I'm going to consider a metric, an FRW metric, which is spatially flat, but I'm going to allow an arbitrary function here, something that goes by the name of the lapse, which just reflects the different possible choices of time coordinates I could do. I could have chosen cosmic time in which n is 1. Or I could choose conformal time in which n equals a, or indeed anything else. And then you just take that metric, and we're going to consider just for the background evolution on FRW that the scalar field itself is only a function of time. Okay, so we're really looking at the evolution of the background. So if I take that ansatz for the metric and I compute the curvature r, it just turns out to be the following quantity. Where dot a dot is dA dt, the rate of change of the scale factor with respect to this arbitrary time. And you see that everywhere you have a d by dt, you also have the n coming with it, which is just a reflection of the fact that it's really n dt is the sort of measure which is invariant under time reparameterizations. So that's the Ricci scalar. If you compute root minus g for a flat metric, then it's just n times a cubed. Because we have a squared 3 times from here, we square root, that gives a cubed, and then we get the n. So we plug that into the action, we get the integral dt, integral d3x, n a cubed, multiplied by, and remember that my convention is that m Planck squared is 1 over 8 pi g, that's the reduced Planck mass. It's the nicest Planck mass because it's the one that gets rid of all the factors of pi. And so plugging that in, we get 3 m Planck squared 1 over n d by dt a dot over n a plus a dot over n a squared. That's the curvature piece. Then we have plus a half phi dot squared over a squared from the kinetic term. So I've inversed the metric. Phi is just a function of t. The only piece we get is the phi dots. And so we get, this is n, sorry, n squared. We get that piece there. The n squared comes from inverting the metric. And then we have the potential V of phi. So that's the effective action for Einstein gravity coupled to some scalar field, which is going to be the inflaton, the thing that drives inflation, on a background geometry. Now, this piece here, this kind of slightly annoying piece, with the which has double derivatives of A, we can actually improve this somewhat by integrating by parts, because this n multiplies by that n and will cancel in this piece. Then we have a total derivative, and a total derivative we can integrate by parts, take the derivative up, bring it over, put it on the a cubed. With a minus sign, you pick up a minus 3a squared a dot, and you find that this term is exactly the same as that term, but with an overall factor of minus 2. When you've done that, you find that the action reduces to the following statement. We have minus 3, so I'll put the na cubed out front, minus 3 m Planck squared h squared, and then we have plus 1 half phi dot squared over n squared, and then minus v of phi, where I have defined h is a dot over na is the Hubble constant, which of course is not very constant. It's a function of t. So that's the natural definition. And again, the n comes with the dot because it's really n dt is the quantity that is invariant under reparameterizations of time if I did t goes to t prime of t. So that's the effective action. This is often called the mini superspace action. Nothing to do with supersymmetry. That name, it's due to DeWitt, I think. That describes the effective action that we need to describe just back the background evolution. And we can get three equations from this thing. We minimize the action with respect to n. And if we do that, you see that the n, you get a 1 over n squared here, but multiplied by n. So this piece has an overall 1 over n. This piece similarly has a 1 over n squared multiplied by n, so it's an overall 1 over n. But this piece is multiplied by n. So when you vary that, you get there's a sign difference in these pieces because of the fact that it's 1 over n, but this piece stays the same. It gives an n. And the n product of that is that equation gives rise to the Freeman equation. So varying with respect to the lapse, so the sign is now flipped between the kinetic term and the potential because this goes like 1 over n squared where that doesn't. Varying with respect to the lapse gives the Friedmann equation. This in ADM language, this is called the Hamiltonian constraint. And you'll find out more about that later on when you do the proper coupling of the fluctuations to gravity. Varying with respect to the scalar field gives the following equation. It's basically phi dot over n 1 over n d by dt. That's just basically phi double dot with the n's in the right places, plus 3 times h 1 over n d phi dt is equal to minus v comma phi. So this is essentially the scalar field equation. And as usual, the equation that we get by varying with respect to A, which is the acceleration equation, This we don't need to do, because it's not independent. Because as soon as we know that formula, which tells us what A dot is, because H is A dot, we can differentiate this equation, plug this relationship in, and that'll determine the equation, the third equation we get. So secretly, there's really only two independent equations here, which is this one, the Friedmann equation, and the equation for the scalar field, and that's all we need to take on board. And you see now why I actually kept the lapse in was because if we'd set the lapse to 1 from the outset, we would not have been able to rederive the Friedmann equation. So that was kind of important for that. However, having derived the equations of motion, we can then just choose n to be whatever we want. We can go to proper time. We can go to conformal time. I'm going to choose proper time for now. So let's set n, the lapse equal to 1. That's nothing to do with the number of e-folds. Unfortunately, they come by the same name, but never mind. So what we're looking at here is basically just the Friedmann equation in its standard form, where this is the energy density, rho, of the inflaton, rho phi. So let's go through and actually work out the acceleration equation to see how it goes. So if we start with h squared is 1 over 3m Planck squared, phi dot squared over 2 plus v of phi, where I've now set n equals 1. If I differentiate this equation, I get 2h, h dot is equal to 1 over 3 m Planck squared, phi dot, phi double dot, plus v comma phi, phi dot. And then the point is, phi double dot here, we already know what phi double dot is from this equation expressed in the gauge where n equals 1, is just this statement. So we can take that relationship and plug it back in, and what do we, lo and behold, what do we find? That this is 1 over 3 m Planck squared. We see that the phi double dot plus v comma phi phi dot, they actually cancel against each other, and this gives you 3h phi dot squared minus, from plugging in there. And so the 3's cancel, and we get minus h phi dot squared over m Planck squared. Or rewriting, we have h dot is minus phi dot squared over 2 m Planck squared. Now, the pressure, the equation of state of this system, if you have a scalar field, its energy density, rho, is a half phi dot squared plus v of phi. But the pressure is actually a half phi dot squared minus v of phi. The pressure is the kinetic term minus the potential term. So remember, what we need to get inflation is that the equation of state should be less than minus a third to get inflation, to get an accelerated region at all. And so that tells us that the ratio of these two things should be less than minus a third. In particular, it's got to be negative to start with. So the fact that this is negative immediately tells us that the potential energy has to be bigger than the kinetic term. And in particular, and normally, in fact, it's usually, or equivalently, so the kinetic term has to be smaller than the potential. So in most inflation models are based on the idea, on this idea. You simply take a scalar field and you set up the initial conditions such that the kinetic energy in that scalar field is subdominant to the potential energy. The kinetic energy is subdominant to the potential energy, then this piece I can neglect, this piece I can neglect, and lo and behold, this ratio W is approximately minus 1. And so that's why it comes out, in most models, it's really minus 1, because if this quantity is much less than V, then this ratio is mostly minus 1. And that's the typical case. In particular, it's the basis. It's always the case in the standard way to get inflation, which is called slow roll inflation. And the picture here is that if I take my potential V of phi in slow roll inflation, so you've got some potential that looks like that, the idea is that you start somewhere up on the potential, but you start with a very small kinetic energy. Now, of course, you're going to fall down. If you're up here, you're not in the minima, so the field is going to roll down. But the equation of motion for the scalar field takes the form phi double dot plus 3h phi dot is minus v comma phi. And this takes the form of this piece here looks like a damping or friction term. This is the piece that comes from, if we were on flat space, we would just have that. And then the scalar field would just roll down, because you're not at the minima, and you would come down and you would oscillate back and forth and so on. But the presence of this piece here creates a friction. And it stops the thing rolling down as fast as you want it to. It's really, you're really damping the system in some way, making it effectively viscous, so it can't roll down very rapidly. And so if this piece is much larger than this one, what happens is that the field velocity phi dot can be made very small if h is sufficiently big. So the slow roll regime is one in which h phi dot is assumed to be much larger than phi double dot, so that you're friction or damping dominated. And in that regime, phi dot is approximately minus v comma phi over 3h. So the idea is the Hubble constant itself is the damping term. The larger I make the Hubble constant, the more this thing will dominate over that. But at the same time, the smaller phi dot will be, because phi dot will then have the h in the denominator. The smaller phi dot is, the easier it is to satisfy this requirement that phi dot is smaller than potential, and then the easier it is to make the equation of state as close to minus 1, and then you'll get inflation. That's basically what slow roll inflation is. And so the physics of it is you start here, you want to roll down, but the damping term means that the rolling down is extremely slow, and so you have this kind of slow rolling, which it's so slow that at each time you think that V is at roughly constant, and so you think you're on an approximate De Sitter space. It goes like that. And eventually it stops, you run down, you oscillate back and forth, and that's when the process of reheating the universe goes through. The energy density of the inflaton from these oscillations gets dumped into the creating matter at the end of inflation through the process of reheating. So basically the requirements to get slow roll inflation are this requirement here, that h phi dot is much bigger than phi double dot, and this requirement here. And these are usually phrased in terms of two slow roll parameters. So we define the following two parameters. Epsilon. So let's think about this ratio. So if we have the slow roll solution, phi dot is v comma phi over h, we want this ratio, phi dot squared over v of phi, to be small. And if we plug in what that is, that basically requires that v comma phi squared over 9h squared v of phi has to be much less than unity. But we know also that h squared, in this region where your potential dominated, h squared will go like v over 3m Planck squared. So this relationship can be encoded in the following parameter. If I define the slow roll parameter v comma phi over v squared, then that condition that phi dot squared over v is smaller than 1 is the statement that this slow roll parameter is less than 1. So epsilon being less than 1 is equivalent to potential domination. That's this condition. And the second condition is that you're damped. That's a condition on the phi double dot being less than h phi dot. And we can infer what that is because we know that phi dot is basically minus v comma phi over 3h. So phi double dot is approximately minus v comma phi 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 dot over 3h, if I'm allowed to neglect the time derivative of h, which I am because that's approximately constant. And so the requirement that phi double dot over h phi dot is much less than unity implies the statement that v comma phi phi over h squared is much less than unity. And this is usually encoded in another slow roll parameter, eta, which is defined as the ratio of m Planck squared v comma phi phi over v, which is approximately the same as v comma phi phi over 3 h squared, and that has to be smaller than 1. So these conditions are both phrased as statements on the potential. So the statement is, you give me a potential, V of phi, I calculate these numbers for you in some particular regime. If those two numbers are small, then you can have a regime where if you set up the initial conditions right, you can have inflation because the kinetic term's small because you're in an overly damped region, and then as long as you start out with a small velocity, you'll roll down in a very small way. This last condition is, in some sense, the most intriguing one, because what you see, v comma phi phi is essentially the mass squared of the inflaton particle. So this is telling you that to get inflation to occur at all, the mass of the inflaton has to be smaller than the Hubble radius during inflation. So the inflaton field has to be a very light field. Well, by light, we mean light relative to the Hubble scale during inflation. So now this is difficult to achieve in realistic models. It's difficult to find light scalar fields whose masses can be kept smaller than the Hubble scale. And that's again, is one of the problems with trying to construct inflation models in fundamental theories. And this is often phrased, because of where it comes in, as the eta problem. Because the problem of keeping eta small, much less than 1, which you need to have the damped evolution, is equivalent to the problem of the mass of the inflaton being smaller than the Hubble scale. And it is implicitly telling you that the inflaton particle, whatever that particle is, has to be a light scalar particle. This guy, on the other hand, is typically quite easy to achieve, because basically I can always make the overall scale of the potential sufficiently large such that I can make V big without V comma phi changing by adding to V a constant so that I make the denominator bigger, but of course the constant drops out of the gradient. And so by making V big enough, I can always make epsilon small. The difficult one to achieve is this one, because it's hard to find a particle whose mass is smaller than the typical scale you need during inflation. Okay. Yeah. Pardon? So the problem is it's not actually small in sort of present day terms. So this, the problem arises, so that, I mean, the Hubble scale, we don't know what the Hubble scale during inflation was. The maximum it can typically be is order 10 to the minus 6 times the Planck scale. Okay, so if you, that's if you have a basically gut scale inflation, that's a very high energy scale. You say, oh, that's not difficult to have the mass that large. That doesn't seem a problem at all. It doesn't seem very light. The problem is that scalar field theories are typically not technically natural, in the sense that the potential is can receive quantum corrections, can receive large quantum corrections. And so when we're talking about the mass here, we shouldn't be just talking about the tree-level mass. We should be talking about the mass, the classical mass, plus the mass coming from quantum corrections. And the problem is that in inflation, the natural scale is the Hubble scale. So the natural scale of correct quantum corrections to the inflaton mass is, at the very least, the Hubble scale. And so you require that the tree-level plus quantum corrections is smaller than H, but the size of the typical quantum corrections you expect is of order H. And so you need some incredible fine-tuning to go on to try and explain that, you know, which is a fine-tuning comparable to the hierarchy problem and the cosmological constant problem. Not quite as severe as the latter, but nevertheless, there's some tuning required here. So different physical mechanisms get around that by different explanations. So one of the most common one is to impose some extra symmetry required that the inflaton field has to satisfy, specifically like a shift symmetry. So in axion kind of models of inflation, the potential looks like a cosine. pi over 2 pi f, just some length scale, mass scale here. And because it's a cosine, there is a shift symmetry phi goes to phi goes to phi plus 2 pi f, because the cosine is periodic. Now, that shift symmetry can basically protect you against quantum corrections and suppress the corrections to the effective mass, getting you around this particular problem. Okay. Also, now, of course, other ways to do it is you actually build your model in some supergravity model, somehow it's natural in that supergravity model that that particular field doesn't receive corrections because of some supersymmetric non-renormalization theorem or something like that. So, yeah, so if even, you know, I say that the mass of the inflaton has to be light. It's not light by present-day terms, but it's light comparison to the Hubble scale at the time of inflation. So it's light relative to the scales at that time when inflation was going on. And that's the difficulty, because that's difficult to deal with, because quantum corrections typically generate masses of order H, at least. In fact, it's usually worse. Okay. Yeah, this is my last one, so Sarah will take over tomorrow. So.
Oh, great. So,
you have to come back next year. Yes.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.